If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I mean, for me, the joy of reading a good book is to find out what happens, but that's also the joy of writing it, to find out what happens.
That was Bernard Cornwell talking to us about the TV adaptation of his book, The Last Kingdom.
I do think we sometimes miss the fact that this was a war of aggression. The French weren't attacking us at the time, and certainly to invade and try and conquer territory was an act of aggression.
And that was Anne Curry discussing the Battle of Agincourt. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your app store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Welcome to our fourth podcast of October 2015. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Tonight, the 22nd of October, a major new historical drama begins on BBC Two, entitled The Last Kingdom. It's based on a series of novels by Bernard Cornwell that focus on the 9th century when England was being battled over by the Vikings and the Anglo-Saxons. Our deputy editor, Charlotte Hodgman, met up with Bernard a little while back to discuss the books that have inspired the BBC's latest historical blockbuster.
Just for listeners who aren't familiar with the books, can you sort of sum up the first two books maybe in a nutshell? What could people expect to see in the series?
Well, I'd sum up the whole series. I mean, there's actually 9 books in it now, but the 9th hasn't been published yet. Most historical novels have a big story and a little story, all right? I mean, you think of Gone with the Wind, and the big story is the Civil War. The little story is can Scarlet save Tara?
Yeah.
And you flip them. You put the little story in the front and the big story in the background. So what these books are about and what the series is about, the big story, which is in the background, is the making of England. Because if you get into your magic time machine and press a button and go back to 850 AD and you said, am I in England? They'd look at you as if you were mad, because they didn't know what England was. There was no England. There was a Mercia and a Wessex and, you know, East Anglia, Northumbria. And yet if you then got back in and you jumped forward 100 years, they'd say, yes, you're in England or Angleland. So it's the story of how was England made? Because we don't know it. I mean, I'm English, and I thought, I don't know. I don't know where England came from. I haven't a clue. And we're not taught it. I mean, Alfred, all we're taught about Alfred is he was a bad cake maker. And that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So what are you going to see? Well, you're going to see a story about the attempt by the Danes to take over the whole of England, so it would what became England. And of course it fails, because we don't live in Daneland, and we're having this interview in English. Mm-hmm. And it's the story is why we're having this conversation in English and living and having it in England.
Okay. I mean, so little is known about that period of history. How did you go about researching, you know, it's based on historical facts?
Well, we know quite a lot about King Alfred.
Yeah.
Because Bishop Asser wrote his life while he was still living, while Alfred was living. And of course, Alfred was very keen on literacy, and he started the Anglo-Saxon Chronicles. So, in fact, the records are quite good. But once Alfred dies in 899, it's rather as if a light goes out, and suddenly it all becomes a lot more mysterious. And the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle can be incredibly frustrating. It will sort of say, in this year, the pagans came, and by the grace of God, they were defeated at. And that's it. And it doesn't tell you how it happened, or who led the army that defeated them, or anything. So a lot of it, I'll be really honest, is imagination. But then my job is to be a storyteller, not an historian. And, you know, if you want to know the history of it, there's plenty of good people. Justin Pollock has written a great life of Alfred. And, you know, those books are there. But my job is to tell you a story, not... I do have a duty to history. I have an enormous duty to history, that big story is more or less accurate.
Yeah.
That I hope when people have finished the series, they'll think, gosh, I didn't know that. I didn't, you know... This is the process by which England was made. But I have to flesh it out with so much fiction, because it is the Dark Ages.
Yeah. I mean, do you prefer, because you've written books about the Napoleonic Wars, do you prefer writing about a time that perhaps you are able to kind of flesh it out a little bit more and use your own sort of imagination, or, you know, Napoleonic Wars?
I don't really mind. I mean, I wrote a couple of books about the American Revolution, Redcoat and the Fort.
Mm.
And because I live in America, I married an American, I'm terribly aware that I'm trespassing on the high ground of American myth. Mm. And you really can't get it wrong. I mean, if you do, you're giving a terrible hostage to fortune.
Yeah.
Luckily, the records are immaculate. I mean, there are so many letters, diaries, and everything else. And in some ways, that's a gift, because it just gives you the stuff which you can then fictionalize, even though you're still putting a small story in the foreground.
Yeah.
But with this, it's sometimes I feel slightly adrift. I think I wish I did know what happened, in the North Midlands in the year 916. But the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle isn't helping me at all. Okay, I'm just going to make it up as I go along. But eventually we're going to touch base again, where, you know, that we have a fact coming up in 918, where we'll, you know, that's where we'll touch fact again.
Yeah, okay.
I like it. No, I do like it. I mean, obviously I like writing. And I don't think that the people who make the TV series should be too worried about the real history. I mean, their job too is to entertain, and we're storytellers, we're entertaining. But we are a gateway to history. I mean, I got interested in history because of the Hornblower books.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And I think that history should be entertaining. And I think it's fine if people settle just for the entertainment. I mean, if all you ever know about Thomas Cromwell is what Hilary Mantel said, great.
Yeah.
It's terrific. But, you know, some people, a few, are going to think, I want to know more. And they're going to go off and find more about Thomas Cromwell. And so
it's
on.
It's like a starting point, like a stepping stone, isn't it?
It's a wonderful gateway to history.
Yeah. And what sort of sense did you get of Viking society? There are a lot of kind of cliches, aren't there, around Vikings? You know, they're sort of seen as sort of brutes. But do you have more of a sense of them as being, you know, a bit more sort of rounded than that?
Well, yes. I mean, there's been a whole sort of revisionist thing recently. We've tried to make out that the Vikings were actually sort of peace-loving vegans, which is equally totally nonsense. And yeah, I mean, these are, in many ways, they're very similar to the Saxons. And I mean, you can say that the whole of the period between the end of the Roman occupation and 1066 is a period of Germanic Scandinavian invasions of Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, Uhtred, my Saxon hero, goes Viking. And there's no reason why the Saxons shouldn't go Viking and be Vikings, and were Vikings at the time. And the Frisians too. Yeah, in the end, what they want to do is they want to settle. They want the land. That's what they're after. They're after the land. And like everybody else, they want security. They want their children to be raised in peace. They want to live to harvest the crops they sowed the year before. But, you know, they're in a struggle for the land because they're taking somebody else's land.
Yeah.
And the Saxons have already got away with that. I mean, they've already taken the British land. I mean, You know, that's where the Welsh call it Llygia, the lost lands. Mm. And the Saxons can't really bitch too much that someone else is coming and doing it to them.
No. So, I mean, the actual series, how much input have you had into you know, what can be, you know, what's used from your
Zip.
Your books? Nothing at all.
Zip, zero.
You've handed them over.
Handed it over totally. I didn't want any input and I didn't want any influence. And the reason for that is that I used to work in television years ago, for the BBC, no less,
okay.
10 or 11 years, and that was in news and current affairs. And so I know a lot about television, a lot, and I know enough about television to know I know nothing about producing television drama. I've never done it, never tried to do it, and I don't know anything about it. And you simply, any input I give them, other than being a cheerleader, is liable to be an obstacle.
Okay.
Or at the worst, you know, a nuisance. And I don't want to be a nuisance to them because they're... And, you know, you also have to have enormous faith in these people. Yeah. They have great imaginations and creativity. I mean, if you're the actor who is playing Uhtred, you've got to feel free to develop him the way you see him. And the scriptwriter too. And when we did the Sharp series, I mean, I changed the way I wrote Sharp because of Sean Bean.
Did you? Okay.
Oh, sure, because he brought something to it, which was terrific. He was an amazing Sharp.
Yeah.
And I still saw my Sharp, the physical Sharp, who didn't quite look like Sean, but my God, I heard Sean's voice all the time. And similarly, Pete Postlethwaite, you know, I mean, all these people brought something to the series which I could use.
Yeah. I mean, the series, I mean, you say the ninth book, so is it not written yet, or it hasn't come out
just
yet?
Just finished. Yes.
It
will come out this September, October.
Will there be a 10th?
Oh, yes.
So do you think you're going to then take something perhaps from this series and bring that to, you know...
Yes, I don't know what it is because I haven't seen anything. But oh, I'd be surprised if I watch this series and it does not have an effect on me. And it's going to have to be... I mean, to give a really stupid example, my Sharp had black hair.
Mm-hmm.
Sean doesn't. So after the TV series came out, I never again mentioned the colour of Sharp's hair in a book. Only so that because so many people would come to those books because of the TV, I didn't want to jar them. The people who already knew Sharp knew he had black hair, so it didn't matter.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the effect is. I mean, maybe none, but I suspect it will have an effect, yeah.
Okay. And going back to the very first book, did you sort of start off, do you plan how the story is going to go?
Wednesday, we flew from home here, right?
Yeah.
So I was getting on a plane that afternoon. I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning because I had to finish the last chapter of the book. Had to. And I had from 3 o'clock until midday to finish it.
Yeah.
I still, at 6 o'clock in the morning, I still didn't know how that chapter would end. Eventually, about 10 o'clock, I thought, oh, yeah.
You got it, yeah.
And... I mean, for me, the joy of reading a good book is to find out what happens, but that's also the joy of writing it, to find out what happens. And it's not the most efficient way to write. I mean, I'd much rather do it the way that other people do, who plot everything out beforehand. I can't do that. I sort of write and find out what happens as I go along, and it often surprises me. And this is the second book in a row where I got to the last chapter and didn't know how it would end.
That could probably... Can that go on for a while, though, not knowing how it's going to end? Or are you sort of the sort of person who would, you know,
You have a vague idea where it'll end. I mean, a very, very vague idea. But it still took me by surprise, the ending.
Okay. And what about your lead character? Was he someone you've been sort of planning or thinking about for a while before you actually started writing the books?
No, I tend to find out about them as I go along.
They sort of grow as well, do they?
Remember, I started him off as a child.
Yes, yeah.
And things happen to him, and that has an effect on him. And no, I don't think that much about them. I let them tell me who they are.
Okay.
I know, it's terrible, isn't it?
Well, no, I think that's a really interesting way of doing it. Like you say, there's lots of different ways of...
And sometimes your readers tell you about them too. I mean, I was probably halfway through the series with Uhtred when I began to notice how many people were writing to the website saying, we love that he behaved badly. And I thought, that's what you want. And so he's proceeded to behave worse and worse and worse.
Is there a period of history that you would like to write about that you haven't yet?
Yes.
What would that be?
I would love to write about the sort of birth of the English theatre.
Okay, so it's quite different then.
Yes. In other words, we're, you know, going back to the 17th century. And again, you know, where does the theatre come from? I mean, it's this extraordinary, sudden appearance of a professional theatre, which, because the Puritans managed to stop in the 17th century, but it comes back in all its glory. Mm. And I think I love the theatre and I love the history of the theatre. And I think it's just, just another wonderful story.
Yeah. And already people are kind of calling this new series sort of the BBC's Game of Thrones, which, I was sort of looking on the internet and, like, lots of people saying that already. Have you seen the series? Is that something you agree with?
I haven't seen Game of Thrones. I've read the book and I know George a bit. Mm. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't want people to be disappointed because we don't have lots of naked women lying around for half of each episode, right? And obviously what George is doing, I mean, he cements his fantasy in a background which is obviously drawn from medieval England. And that gives it a realism, which is necessary. This is slightly different, I mean, in the sense that the background here is real. I mean, it is the making of England, and it is it's a slightly different era. I mean, I think George probably is setting his more or less in the sort of Wars of the Roses. We're going way, way back. No, I mean, I'm flattered. I mean, let's hope it has the same effect. But, I mean, I do think that obviously many of the elements of Game of Thrones are not in this.
No.
And shouldn't be.
No. And when you, obviously, you mentioned that you, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle and some of the sources from the time. What about things like the detail, like the clothing and things like that? Do you pay much attention to that type of...
you do, yeah. I mean, I've actually got, a couple of books on it. I don't go into great detail on clothing because it's not something that terribly interests me.
No.
I do occasionally, yes.
But that sort of, detail, to you, that is important. That is
yes.
That was Bernard Cornwell, one of Britain's best-known historical novelists, and the author of the books that inspired The Last Kingdom. As well as interviewing Bernard, Charlotte also managed to grab a few words with Stephen Butchard, the writer who has adapted the novels for the small screen.
Stephen, you're the scriptwriter for the series.
Yeah.
For the listeners' perspective, what does that actually involve? So have you had to read all Bernard's books and then you make a script out of that? What was your kind of brief when you took the project on?
Well, this series one is is 8 1-hour episodes.
Yeah.
And it covers the first two books, The Last Kingdom and The Pale Horseman. So my first job would be to read the books.
Yeah.
and it's not so much to remember details like that, it's to try and get a sense of what it's about.
Yeah.
And that sounds odd, but it means, for me it means it's important, what a character is feeling. So what's the general, if you had to sum up a book in a sentence, what would it be? What's the film about? And you don't want to go into this happened, but it's just generally, what is this about? And it's kind of summed up in that this is about a boy who's taken as a Saxon and brought up a Dane. And that's the important thing to remember. So he's in these conflicted worlds, and that's always where the drama is.
Yeah.
So he's been stolen from one world, taken to another, but then abandoned by both worlds. So it's him trying to find a place all the time. So I've read the books, and that's like the sense of it. But all the time, you kind of have to keep that nugget at the sense of everything that happens. So that's there.
How do you sort of go about engaging a modern audience with something? I mean, that's a world so alien to us. I mean, in terms of sort of, language and script and things like that, how do you do that?
It's got to be about the character. Mm. If you don't care for the person on the screen, if you don't care for the character, you're not going to engage. So you have to present rounded characters and they have to be doing something. It doesn't matter, what world you're in. In this world, if we have a battle, no one is going to care about what happens in the battle if you don't care for the individuals winning the battle.
Yeah, it's true.
So that's where it all comes from. You've got to connect emotionally. So that's what it's about. It's about making these people feel as real as possible. And that's with the books, Uhtred is the central character in the Alfred book, but it's growing them more and then growing the other characters as well. And that's how you do it. In terms of language that they use, it's the 9th century. We don't really know what people spoke. What language even. There must have been all kinds of dialects and mixes. But I knew there had to be a distance between now and then. But you don't want that distance to be alienating. You don't want RP. You don't want actors with a pole at the backside. Anything like that. You want it to sound naturalistic, but there has to be that distance.
Yeah.
So, you try and find the ground, where it sounds naturalistic. And again, that's about the character as well. No, because you want people to be engaged.
And to care, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what it's all about. That's the most important thing in drama is making people care about the characters.
Have you come across any sort of challenges when you were sort of coming up with the scripts?
You have to choose your through line. You're across the two books, what's this about? And it is basically about the Last Kingdom. The title of the first book, both books feed into that. Wessex is the last free kingdom of England. It's surrounded by Danes. Alfred is the king of Wessex, and into his court comes this Saxon-born boy with the sensibilities of a Dane. Yeah. And he becomes Alfred's main weapon against the Danes, but equally he doesn't trust him. So that's why I remember, and then that's my through line. Everything is about, for Alfred, saving Wessex, but everything for Uhtred is about finding himself and finding his way home to Northumbria.
So it all comes back to that.
Yeah, so all the time, and everything kind of feeds in to those central things. So it's finding the through line through the books, and there's things that you have to lose. You can't follow it. There's the certain characters that you grow, the certain characters that you lose. The challenge of the first book was that he is predominantly a boy. He's 11 years, 12 years of age in the first book. But as an audience, we want to invest in our adult hero as soon as possible. So that means, he's an adult by my episode one. I'm only 1/8. Through it.
Okay, yeah, I hadn't thought of that, actually.
So therefore, I have to, be careful. Well, what do we really want from when he's a boy and stuff like that? And then just changing certain events in little ways so it fits to him as a man.
So were you kind of part of the filming process? So, were you sort of tweaking the script according to, the actors and how they, how they interpret things?
Well, when we started filming, I'd written 4 scripts when we started, so I still had 4 to write. And that was only possible because we started in November, but then we had a break over the Christmas and let the really bad weather ebb in January. So we had about 6 weeks off in between. But scripts are rewritten. You don't get everything right first time. So you have to have to do that draft, and then locations may change. So you change little things and stuff like that. But you do. As we start filming, I'm seeing what we film each day, so you see how certain actors are or what sets like and stuff like that, and actors bring certain things to your character, so they do change slightly. Sometimes you do find, or if you fall in love with an actor, that's absolutely brilliant, I can write him for him or her, till the cows come home and stuff like that. You got to be kind of careful that you do want to write more for them, but it's got to be within the confines of the story. There's a limited fluidity about the scripts. You have to tell your story, but with scripts, you also have to be aware of constraints like budgets as well. But also with this story, you've got to be careful of repetition, because how many battles do you want? So I've said this before, is the thing, you do literally have to choose your battles. Because you can't have a fight every week, otherwise you're like, it's another battle, and how different can they be? So when you have a battle, there's got to be a lead up to it, and there's got to be fallout, so you choose it to make the most of the lead out and the effect on the characters. So it all boils down to characters, really.
That was Stephen Butchard. And as I mentioned at the start, The Last Kingdom begins tonight, the 22nd of October, at 9 p.m. on BBC Two. And it should then be subsequently available on the BBC iPlayer. And if you'd like to know more about the historical backdrop to The Last Kingdom, then why not check out our November issue, which includes an article on 9th century England, written by Ryan Lavelle, who was a historical advisor on the series. Also in the November issue, there are articles on spies in World War II, the American Revolution, the Celts, and ancient Egypt. You can get hold of our November edition now in all good newsagents and digitally.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Now it's time for the latest history news with our digital editor, Emma McFarnan.
A pile of bones discovered 140 years ago in a pub in North Wales could be the remains of an English Catholic priest who was hanged, drawn and quartered for his religious beliefs, it has been claimed. University of Edinburgh specialists have carried out forensic tests on the bone fragments, which included part of a skull and a leg, and concluded that they belonged to a priest who was killed in this manner in the 17th century. According to the Catholic news agency, the bones could belong to St. John Plessingdon, who was executed in Chester in 1679 as a result of strict Elizabethan-era laws that stated being a Catholic priest was an offence of high treason. The bones were discovered in the late 19th century at the Oldie Star Inn next to St. Winifred's Well, Holywell, in North Wales. The bones were reportedly found in a bundle of 17th century children's clothing and hidden inside a trunk. The current Bishop of Shrewsbury has launched an appeal for donations to carry out further DNA tests on the remains. In other news, a First World War poison gas factory used to produce nearly 390,000 mustard gas shells towards the end of the conflict has been added to a list of England's most at-risk heritage buildings. The growth of trees and shrubs threatens to destroy the remains of the Northamptonshire factory, which was built in just 3 months in 1916 under an emergency scheme overseen by then Munitions Minister David Lloyd George. Historic England has added the remains of the munitions plant to its annual Heritage at Risk register, which was published on the 20th of October. Other buildings added to the register include a Napoleonic-era lookout post in Essex, a Victorian pub in Wandsworth, London, and the Old Pier Lighthouse in Sunderland, which dates from 1856.
This Sunday, the 25th of October, we'll see the 600th anniversary of the Battle of Agincourt, one of England's best-known medieval triumphs. To find out more about the events of October 1415, I caught up with Professor Anne Curry of the University of Southampton, one of the world's leading experts on the battle. I began by asking her how the English and French armies had come to blows in the first place.
The Battle of Agincourt came about because the French intercepted Henry V on his way back to England. Henry didn't intend to fight a battle. He intended to fight a campaign of conquest, but he abandoned that conquest after the siege of Harfleur had taken him too long. So we find him trying to get away from Harfleur to Calais as quickly as possible. The French threaten him at the Somme. He therefore moves inland a long way, but eventually manages to cross the river. But the French still intercept him before he manages to get to the safety of Calais. So that's why the battle is fought actually quite close to Calais.
What was he doing campaigning in France in the first place?
Henry V's campaigning in France, really, because his ancestors had campaigned in France. He's following up the claim of Edward III to the throne of France. But it isn't just that his historic claim to territory in France and to royal titles in France. It's also because Henry is only the second king of a new dynasty, the Lancastrian dynasty. So he's keen to establish the dynasty's position in England, and he's keen to establish his own position as king. When he invades France, he's only been king for 2 years. So it's really part of proving himself and proving his power and his dynasty within the nation.
At the start of the battle, what were the respective strengths of the two armies? And I know this is a subject that's still quite hotly contested.
The sizes of the armies are contested and will continue to be because we don't have very much financial material for the French army. For the English army, I argue that we have got enough material. We know how many set off in the first place. We can prove that at least 11,200 set off, and there seem to be some retinues missing, so we may be approaching 12,000. We know that Henry had to put 1,200 into garrison at Harfleur after he took it. We know that 1,500 names are on the sick list. We know that a few men died at the siege of Harfleur, although so far I've only found about 50. So I've estimated perhaps around 8,500 men were still with him on that march. But the point about it is he has a relatively low proportion of men-at-arms, maybe 1,000 to 1,500 men-at-arms with the rest archers. As for the French, we honestly don't know how many they had there, but we know that they raised a tax to fund an army of 9,000. And so if we add in other troops that responded to what's called the summons des nobles, the summons to nobles to turn up, and we know that people turned up from the north of France. Most of the dead are from Normandy, Picardy and Artois. I don't think 12,000 is unreasonable. My figure is lower than many other people's because I argue the king wasn't there in person, nor was the Dauphin, so the army's bound to be lower than when they would have been there. France was still politically divided. The Duke of Burgundy wasn't there. Other key players like the Duke of Brittany wasn't there in person. The Duke of Berry wasn't there in person. So I think those all sort of take the total downwards rather than upwards. And I think you've got to be realistic as well. If you look at the terrain itself, the higher numbers given just couldn't fit in. We know the French weren't raising armies of 20,000 till the end of the 15th century. And I think also you can't feed an army like that in the field for very long. You know, the English move across territory, so do the French. That's often missed out of the account. So they had a lot of difficulty because of loyalties, because of just the sheer logistics of it. So I don't think 12,000 is unreasonable.
As we know, of course, England famously won this battle. What do you see as the most important reasons for the English victory?
The most important reasons for the English victory are, I think, twofold. The first is leadership. Henry V's presence there is absolutely key, and it contrasts with a lack of leadership on the French side. The leading French general, if you like, was the 21-year-old Duke of Orleans, who had no military experience at all. So he's a leader because he's the most senior nobleman there of the royal house. And it seems as though he and the Duke of Bourbon were the ones that called the shots, as opposed to the Marshal Boucicault and the Constable d'Albret, the sort of more seasoned commanders who may have indeed urged not to give battle against the French. So I think we've got a contrast in leadership. Henry'd also been with his men for many months by now, and so they trusted him. He'd chosen his commanders on the day, his cousin, the Duke of York, to command the vanguard, Thomas Lord Camoys, again married to a relative, to command the rear guard, Sir Thomas Erpingham, often said to be the commander of the archers, not wholly sure, but he certainly had a command role because he throws the baton up into the air and the advance begins. So, you know, the leadership element is absolutely key. The second reason is the archers. And I think here we've got to remember that the value of archers is in their sheer mass, that we're not looking for sharpshooters, Robin Hoods, who can sort of pierce a man-at-arms armour. What we're looking for is the mass effect. I mean, say 7,000 or so archers in volleys. They don't need to be all doing 15 a minute, so we're going to get them in sort of volleys against the French. It's just so destructive against the cavalry charge of the French and against the French advance on foot. the horses rear up, throw their riders. In fact, probably the French commanders couldn't get enough men to join the cavalry attack against the archers because they were worried about what would happen to their horses. The archers are protected by their stakes, and so they can continue shooting from behind them. As for the advance of the French foot, they were hoping by their sheer weight of numbers, so many more men at arms than on the English side, just to sort of steamroller really across the English men at arms, but that some of them never even got there. The arrows forced them into a funneling effect. They collided into each other, fell over, others piled on top of them. They got so close they couldn't raise their weapon arms. And so they're just easy pickings for even archers to sort of jump into the heaps and to kill them there. And I think the telling point, although we have to be bringing the killing of the prisoners to this, is just how few deaths there were on the English side as opposed to on the French side. Because given these men-at-arms are equally well-equipped and trained in the same way, in a hand-to-hand fight in the melee, we'd have expected reasonably equal mortality rates. We have maybe a couple of hundred English dead and maybe 2,000 French dead. So that indicates that they never really got to grips. They died from other reasons.
Do you think with better leadership there was any way the French could have actually won the battle?
I don't honestly think they could have matched the English arrow power. I mean, the French did have archers there, but not enough, really, and they seem to have chosen not to use them. I think they couldn't have beaten the English in that archer-rich situation. After all, they hadn't at Crecy, and they hadn't at Poitiers. So it was a huge risk, even giving battle against the English with that situation. Also, I'd add that you can't train against archers. You can't train against those volleys of arrows, whereas you can train to fight in the melee and to use your lance and your sword and that kind of thing. So actually, I don't think they could have defeated the English.
Something you mentioned or referred to earlier was one of the most controversial aspects of the battle was the killing of French prisoners. I mean, would this have been controversial at the time, or was it just as part of medieval warfare?
The killing of the prisoners wasn't controversial at the time. It is reported in most chronicles, and it is linked to Henry's fear that a new French attack was coming. Now, that's quite important because it shows that his army had been stood down. They'd had time to search amongst the heaps for the living. They'd even had time to collect them together. And then, according to one eyewitness account on the French side, a shout went up that the Duke of Brabant was coming, and Henry ordered the prisoners to be put in a barn and the barn set on fire. Now, clearly, he'd stood his men down. They'd presumably taken their gauntlets and their helmets off, put down their weapons. It was inevitable that he had to. He didn't think they were in a position to meet a new French challenge. The prisoners clearly are a challenge in their own right. They could have used their fists or whatever. It just was a very disruptive thing, and therefore he had to take that kind of evasive action. Whether any fighting then followed is really difficult to tell. The post-killing of the prisoners situation is very varied in the different chronicles. Some say, you know, that Henry sent a herald to tell the French what he was doing, and he said, "I'll keep doing this unless you go away." Well, we don't really know. Or did they see it happening? Or did they know about it in some way, then not attack? Or did they attack and then Henry's men beat them off? We don't actually know. And that's quite an interesting point. We don't know what happened after the killing of the prisoners.
But they didn't kill all the prisoners, am I right? There were still quite a few that did survive.
They didn't kill all the prisoners, and so far we've been able to identify 320 men who were prisoners and held to ransom. I mean, the ransom records are pretty good. Maybe there are more, but 320 is quite interesting. So far we've only been able to identify 500 dead.
But what was the impact of Agincourt on the wider Hundred Years' War?
The immediate impact of Agincourt isn't that great. Rather like Crecy, it was such a great disaster for the French in terms of losing peers that the French king didn't want to negotiate. You know, it was such a disaster, they couldn't really force themselves to come to any terms. I think in the medium term, it meant that the French never wanted to face Henry V in battle again. So they didn't rescue Rouen when he besieged it in 1418-19. But in the longer term, other than giving Henry the high ground, you know, and to show what an effective ruler and military leader he was, the crucial thing is the Treaty of Troyes of 1420 that made him heir to the throne of France. And that came about really because of the civil war in France. The Dauphin arranged the assassination of the Duke of Burgundy. The Burgundians then allied with the English, and the rest, as they say, is history. It made it possible for Henry then to push the advantage and to be accepted by the French king as his heir, and the Dauphin is disinherited. Things might have stayed like that, and Henry V may have gone on to be a very successful king of France, but he died in 1422, a few weeks before his father-in-law, Charles VI, and therefore he's succeeded with a nine-month-old baby in England and ostensibly in France, whereas the Dauphin, involved in the killing of the Duke of Burgundy in 1419, is Charles VII, who is assisted by Joan of Arc to the throne in 1429. So I think you could say Henry V died too young, maybe to sort of pull off the full advantages of his battle victory, of his conquest of Normandy, and of gaining the inheritance to France through a treaty.
With that in mind, is it fair to say that Agincourt actually is not one of England's most important battles?
I think Agincourt is a very important battle for our national psyche, really. We still see it as a great national victory. We still see it as the victory of the common man against the aristocracy of France. We see it then as epitomising our national and natural democracy, that we've always been a kingdom country where the lower class in society are important. Also, it was so important for us in all those many years in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries when we were at war with the French. It sort of stood for our military superiority over the French. So I think it's its legacy almost that's as important. And of course, Shakespeare has a huge role in that. Agincourt is a famous battle today because people have seen it so often and they've heard it so often through the words of Shakespeare.
Coming on to Shakespeare, how close is the Shakespeare version, as far as we know, to what actually happened in the battle?
The Shakespeare version is based on Holinshed's Chronicle, largely, and that itself was based on Hall's Chronicle. Hall did use some of the texts of the 15th century there, but most importantly, he used Monstrelet. He used a printed version of a French chronicle, and that is how some of the things get into the play. For instance, the naming of the battle after the castle that stood nearby, that's not in any English text in the 15th century, but it is in this Burgundian Chronicle of Monstrelet written in the 1440s. So you could say that it sort of picks up from a variety of sources some of the things that can be traced back to the 15th century, but it adds in other things. The peers that are there are wrong. For instance, there's no Duke of Bedford there. He's the one, the brother left back in England there. There is no funny Scotsman and Irishman and Welshman. You know, all of those are dramatic elements in it. We don't know that Henry went round the camp in the way that Shakespeare has him go round. And critics who've written on the play show how influential, say, Roman generals are on it, i.e. Shakespeare was calling on all kinds of influences in that play. Henry didn't say the things Shakespeare has him say. He would have had a battle speech of some sort. So there's a lot of literary invention. And maybe the most intriguing thing is there are no archers in Shakespeare's Henry V. So maybe that's the major reason why it isn't an accurate play. Ironically, there is another play called The Famous Victories of Henry V, written a little bit before Shakespeare's play, and that does have archers in it, does have stakes in it. Those are completely missing from Shakespeare.
That's really interesting about the archers, because I imagine the view we have of Agincourt today is very much influenced by Shakespeare, and yet for most people, Agincourt is all about archers. So how have the archers come back into that story?
I think the archers came back, I mean, they're reasonably prominent in the texts of the time, although, of course, they only operate there as groups. You know, these chronicles only mention the great and the good, particularly Henry himself, and maybe the Duke of Gloucester, his brother who fell and the king stood over him. The archers are there in Hall and Holinshed, They get built up, though, as the centuries go on. When the English start getting interested in archery as a sport, which is starting in the 17th century, but really being built up in the 19th century, that's when it comes in. But I think it is also our democratization. It's where we start in the 19th century with larger working class populations. We're interpreting our history in a different kind of way. We're wanting to say that those working class heroes, if you like, you know, were there already. You can see this in Dickens' Child's History of England in the 1850s, where he sort of says these yeomen, you know, not gentlemen by any means, but they sort of beat the hell out of the French aristocracy. The First World War is a great stimulus as well. And in the writings of that period, and even into the Second World War, you get this idea that the archers are sort of Tommies of the 15th century. Just one illustration of that, when Olivier's film was produced and released in the autumn of 1944, educational materials were produced to accompany it, and a sort of mock lecture was given, and the lecturer was calling the archers the Tommy Atkins of the medieval period. So it's sort of linking back across the centuries. Now, the V-sign story is part of that, isn't it? These are men just like us. They're not kings, they're not nobles, they're just like us, and they therefore have rude gestures. People love the story as well. Again, it's not true any more than the V sign is, that the archers or the English army all had diarrhea at the time of the battle, and that's why the archers all had loose hose and that kind of thing. In fact, the loose hose is mentioned in contemporary chronicles, again, Burgundian ones, but it's all to do with their ease of movement. It isn't at all connected in the text. There's no mention of this about them having diarrhea, but that's a modern idea. And again, it's just like us, isn't it? We've all been to France and eaten too much seafood or whatever. You know, that I think we identify with these archers.
How much do we actually know about the people who were in Henry's army?
We know a huge amount about the people who are in Henry's army because we have muster rolls taken before the campaign. We have some rolls taken during the campaign and then afterwards as well. I think so far I'm on about 8,600 names of people that I know were on the expedition. I'm trying to trace, you know, who died at Harfleur, who was invalided home there, who was actually at the battle. And we can say quite a lot about some retinues, for instance, the Earl Marshal's retinue, the Earl of Norfolk. We know that he had his barber with him on the campaign. We know he had other household servants with him. And I'm sure more work will go on. In fact, I've got a PhD student starting with me, funded by the Gosling Foundation, to look in a bit more detail at who these men were and how they are linked to each other. Quite a number of family groups there on the campaign, and men from different parts of England and South Wales on the campaign.
So what are the big unknowns about Agincourt? What would historians like yourself still most like to find out about the battle?
Where it was fought, I'd say, is the main one. We cannot be too sure exactly where it was fought. The earliest map puts it to the west of the village of Azincourt, but today we think of it that the field is actually the east of Azincourt. That's been thought to be the field since at least the early 19th century, whereas this map that I talked of is sort of later in the 18th century. But so far we haven't had major battlefield archaeology there. That's been undertaken has found nothing relevant at all to the battle. So we're not looking quite the right place. There are various possibilities within the sort of envelope of Azincourt. So I'm sure that there can be further field work, but that would be useful, as it was for Bosworth. Of course, this is a pre-gunpowder battle. The French did have some guns there, but the English don't seem to have done, and therefore if we do find that, we're not so likely to find the metal gun stones that we found at Bosworth. It just makes it so much easier if you've got gunpowder, metal gunpowder artillery. But I'm optimistic that there will be some finds in due course. So that's the major unknown. The other is the French army, but I think we can keep going on that. I and historians in France are trying all the time to collect references to people at the battle, and I'm sure we'll be able to come to some firmer figures on the people who died, because these are actual individuals. You know, we can trace the succession disputes, we can trace lines coming to an end, we can trace new office holders in place. So I'm optimistic again, with more documentary work in France, we can push forward the frontiers of knowledge on that.
And I know you're very much involved in the 600th anniversary commemorations. Could you give us a bit of an idea of some of the most important things that are happening?
Yeah, Agincourt 600 is a charity that was set up some time ago, but in March, the Chancellor of the Exchequer announced £1 million to fund activities linked to the commemoration of the battle. Similar sums have been given to Magna Carta earlier, and in March this year were given to Waterloo too. And we've had various activities that have been funded, and also we've taken applications from other organisations. So the main one coming up is on the 29th of October, which is a service in Westminster Abbey, and that will be a very impressive affair. There's a lot of involvement by the City of London, the livery companies, the Lord Mayor, because London made a very hefty loan to support Henry's campaign in 1415, but that event will have the presence of the French there, the mayor of the group of communes in which Azincourt lies will be reading a text from 1915, because in 1915 the French invited the British soldiers in the area, First World War of course, to share the day with them and to sort of shake hands over this piece of land that had been the site of conflict in the past, but now they were brothers together against a common enemy. So it's quite nice that that allusion is being evoked as well. When the unknown warrior was buried in Westminster Abbey, allusions were made to Henry V being buried close by in the Abbey. So that is the big formal event. And then, of course, we've got the events on the battlefield itself on the 25th of October. Agincourt 600 has paid for a new memorial to the dead of both sides. And there will be an international reunion on the battlefield on that day, and a concert the evening before by the orchestra of the National Gendarmerie. The French commemorate Agincourt particularly through a man called Gallois Le Fougère, who was provost marshal in charge of discipline in the French army. He was killed at the battle. He was buried at Auchy-le-Hedin, Franciscan monastery quite nearby, and he was dug up and is now, in fact, buried at the National Gendarmerie Memorial at Versailles, and he's claimed to be the first gendarme to die in a pitched battle for the Kingdom of France. So the National Gendarmerie are heavily involved in these commemorations on the battlefield on the 25th of October.
And so when you talk about these battlefield commemorations, where are they choosing to site the battlefield?
Well, they're choosing to site it between Azincourt and Tramcourt, as it is described in the Burgundian chronicles and as it become the traditional site. I mean, at present, we can do no more than to use that area between those two settlements, i.e. the traditional field. And indeed, some new boards are being put up there. We're not putting on each one. This is alleged to be, we just got to throw caution to the wind in a way with this. But it will be interesting to see whether, like Bosworth, a few years down the road, we will be having to move the boards to somewhere else.
Do you think this is an anniversary we should be celebrating or just commemorating here in Britain?
I think commemorating and not celebrating. I do think we sometimes miss the fact that this was a war of aggression. Okay, Henry V had a claim to the throne of France, but really it was water under the bridge. Edward III had a better claim and had failed to implement it, and then had lost the lands he'd gained by treaty. The French weren't attacking us at the time, and certainly to invade and try and conquer territory, you know, was an act of aggression. It was an obsession with Henry V. He raised a very large army, the largest to go to France since 1346. He was the first king to lead an army to France since 1359. So he was trying to make his mark big time there. He couldn't afford to go. He had to raid the royal jewel cupboard. He had to borrow loads of money to go. And, you know, you could say that this isn't really the sort of activity that we should be applauding now. I do think, though, in England and in the English-speaking world, there is this bit of jingoism about it. You know, we do think it's all right. Get these books about, you know, insulting the French over the centuries. It's a bit of a joke, isn't it? You know, sort of, ho, 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 we beat the French at Agincourt. But maybe we shouldn't be thinking about it in that way. As a historian, it's easy for me because I can have a professional interest in how things happened in the past and how today we might reconstruct them and analyse them using proper historical method. So it's perhaps easy for me, but I do worry sometimes at the rather over-enthusiastic response we get to getting one up against the French.
That was Anne Curry. Anne has written several books on the Battle of Agincourt, including Great Battles, Agincourt, which is out now in the UK and the US, published by Oxford University Press. And if you're interested in finding out more about the battle, then you might like to check out a major exhibition on Agincourt that's running at the Tower of London from the 23rd of October until the 31st of January next year. Visit hrp.org.uk for more details. And there is also a dedicated website for the anniversary, which can be found at agincourt600.com. Professor Anne Curry wrote a piece on Agincourt for our October issue, which is no longer on sale, but can still be purchased as a back issue, in print and in some of our digital formats. Well, that's pretty much it for this week, but please do listen in next time, when we'll be talking about espionage with Max Hastings, and Andrea Wolf will be discussing the German polymath Alexander von Humboldt. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.